is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Macro Voices episode 47 was recorded on January 26th, 2017. I'm Eric Townsend. Gluskin Chef Chief Economist David Rosenberg will be joining me as today's featured interview guest. We'll discuss the Trump rally, David's outlook for the dollars, both U.S. and Canadian, whether the 35-year bond bull market really is over or not, and much, much more.
And I'm Patrick Ceresna. Eric, the S&P 500 has broken out yet again to an all-time new high, flirting with the 2300 level in the overnight futures trading session on Wednesday night. What's your update on the stock market outlook?
Well, remember what I said last week is we were about to test this sell the inauguration view, and I said that was likely to be a downdraft in the market, but boy, if there was not, it would be a strong message. Well, we got that strong message this week because not only is there no downdraft, but we're breaking out very decisively to new highs here. And, you know, I don't believe in this rally. I don't think the fundamentals are there, but you can't fight the tape. And as I said last week, I don't want to be short here. There's a lot of momentum to the upside. My personal style of trading is I don't buy things I don't believe in. Now, a lot of people would say that's wrong. They would say you just want, you know, the trend is your friend. Doesn't matter if it makes sense to you or not. Figure out what the trend is and bet on it. That's not my style, but I certainly understand that, you know, other people have different styles. I'm on the sidelines, though, waiting to see what happens.
All right. Well, let's cover the U.S. dollar index next, since the value of the dollar is the denominator in just about everything else. So we saw that dollar index futures trade as low as 99.76 overnight. Any change in your outlook on the dollar?
No, you know, we're still holding above key support. I think you've got to differentiate Donald Trump's words that he thinks he would like the dollar to be lower versus his actions. All of his policies are dollar bullish. So I think that this weakness is a buying opportunity. I did increase my position on the weakness. I think that we're headed higher from here. The caveat that I would throw out, though, is the long dollar trade is definitely overcrowded. So if there was some more dollar down rhetoric and it triggered some kind of a panic and everybody's jumping off of one side of the boat at the same time, that could definitely result in a major sell-off. So I'm watching carefully. If the DX trades below 99, I start to get worried. But as long as we're staying up here above 99, I'm not too concerned about it.
Well, let's move on to crude oil. West Texas Intermediate crude has been fluctuating up and down around this 53 level all week. What's going on with oil?
Patrick, let's start with inventory. 2.8 million barrel nationwide build on crude oil inventories. Cushing, Oklahoma saw a very small drawdown of 284,000 barrels. The big story, though, gasoline plus 6.8 million barrels. That's the second week in a row of 6 million barrel builds in gasoline. Distillates, a de minimis 76,000 barrel build. So, you know, huge, huge builds in gasoline. And at the same time, we're seeing moderate builds in crude oil inventories. These should be bearish factors. The OPEC, NOPEC compliance skepticism is on the rise. Of course, it's hard for me to process this idea of skepticism because I never really believed in this deal to start with myself. So I think it's mostly about sentiment. We've seen a lot of big actions, though, from Donald Trump already in his first few days of office, but we haven't seen anything yet on ISIS. And that's really what I'm waiting for, Patrick, is to see what Trump's stance is going to be on how he deals with ISIS, because I think that if he takes a very strong stance, it could potentially result in a lot of geopolitical tension and fear, and that could send both gold and oil much higher.
Now let's talk about gold. Gold tested that 1,220 level and appears to have rolled over this week, trading as low as 1,184 on Thursday, and right now closing near around 1,188. What's your take on gold?
Well, Patrick, I think that the bounce up in gold was mostly about dollar weakness. You know, as we saw the dollar index weakening, gold, of course, strengthens. And I think that was most of what the 1220 move was about. And the reason I think that we're starting to see it roll over is it looks to me like we've kind of tested as far down as we're going to go. We're back up over 100 now on the dollar index. And as long as the dollar continues to strengthen, which I think that it will here, then I think gold is probably headed lower. But of course, as I mentioned before, a sudden change in presidential policy, particularly having to do with geopolitical threats that could come out of getting tough with ISIS, is where I would see maybe a move higher. But as long as the dollar index holds its support level, I think that gold's rally is over unless there's a geopolitical upset.
Now let's move on to treasuries. Those 10-year treasury yields edged back up toward the 2.5% level this week. Anything new on your fixed income outlook?
It was actually 254 this morning. You know, that's what, 6 basis points away from the red line in the sand that Bill Gross drew. So I definitely think that the question of the year, the big question of the year, is whether the secular bull market in bonds is over or not. It is just the biggest news of our careers if it is. It's such a huge secular change. I'm not persuaded that it is over yet. I still continue to see a lot of possibility that this backup in yields was temporary, and that we're still headed lower, especially if we get some real recession risk. Nothing on the immediate horizon, but from a business cycle standpoint, we're long in the tooth here and we're overdue for a recession. I think that we really have to get, though, to the bottom of Donald Trump's rhetoric versus actions. You know, if he follows through on this dollar is too high rhetoric by actually taking actions to lower the dollar, that would change everything. I don't see that coming, though. The president doesn't really have the ability to throw a switch and say, I want a lower dollar index. What he does have the ability to do is tell foreign corporations to repatriate assets to the United States, tell people, you know, car companies to build plants in the United States, do these other policy things that are all very dollar bullish. So I think that unless Trump really takes action to change the direction of the dollar, and also with respect to FOMC policy, you know, he's been on their case to not artificially suppress interest rates. Unless he decides to do a complete 180 on that, I think that we're potentially headed, at least in the short end of the curve, towards higher rates, as supposedly we're looking at 3 more hiking cycles. So it's going to be very interesting to see what happens to the long end of the curve and, you know, what the shape of the yield curve turns out to be over the next year.
Well, thanks for that market update, Eric. Now, David Rosenberg is the chief economist for the Canadian wealth management firm Gluskin Sheff, and his Breakfast with Dave newsletter is one of the best known and respected daily publications in the industry. Eric's interview with David Rosenberg is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next is Gluskin Sheff's chief economist, David Rosenberg. And of course, Dave is the author of Breakfast with Dave, probably one of the best and most well-known newsletters that's produced every single day in the industry. So Dave, thanks so much for joining us. I want to start with your outlook on equities. Frankly, I'm not sure if I need to talk to an economist or a psychiatrist to get my head around this equity market. But, let's go back 3 to 6 months. We had the smartest guys in the room. Ray Dalio, Stan Druckenmiller, Carl Icahn, they were all saying, I thought for very good reasons, this market's overdone, it's overbought, you know, it's gone too far. And now Donald Trump gets elected. This guy's going to have more headwinds in terms of political opposition than any president in recent history. Yet it seems that everybody has just decided that it's straight up and away from here. Overnight last night, S&P futures touched 2999 spot 50. So if the cash index had been traded, it would have broken 2300. Is it just me? I mean, everybody's talking about the analogy to Trump is the new Ronald Reagan, and I can't help but think, wait a minute, first 2 years of Reagan's presidency was a massive bear market and recession. Am I missing something here, Dave?
Well, you know, the other thing, I don't think you're missing anything, no. I mean, the Reagan presidency as well, you know, and it goes to show in those first 2 years after the honeymoon period when the market was down 25%, that really, basis point for basis point, what matters, you know, for the markets is the shift in the market multiple as opposed to earnings growth. And The Fed certainly showed its hands. Volcker raised 800 basis points, and we had a recession starting 6 months after Reagan got elected. And people looked benevolently, of course, on the entire Reagan regime, the entire 8 years. And a lot of that wasn't just his, pro-business stance, but also the fact that the Fed continued to cut interest rates that reinforced the expansion of the market multiple. But remember that the starting point in 1982 for the bull market was a multiple that was 8, not 17 on forward and almost 20 on trailing. And at that point, the onset of the bull market occurred in 1982 after a huge recession. This time around, not only are valuations at 15-year highs, but we're entering into the eighth year of the expansion of the bull market. You have to respect where we are in the market cycle and the business expansion, and we're much more mature now than we were in the that early stage of Reagan, or you can argue the early stage of Bill Clinton or Barack Obama. I mean, the benefit of being elected at the bottom of the cycle, then you can just write it up and take credit for it. I think that the challenge for Donald Trump, with all deference to this animal spirit rally that we're seeing right now, is that the multiples are really stretched, and that maybe if we're not even in the ninth inning of the game here, we're certainly somewhere in and around the seventh inning stretch. So the answer is no. It's not like Ronald Reagan at all in that regard.
And in terms of where we are and what comes next, obviously, we, as much as you and I see a lot of reason for concern here, you can't fight the tape. And clearly, the trend has been upward. So are we going to see several months, do you think, of exuberance over this election before reality sets in? And it seems to me like a lot of people seem to think we're in a new inflationary boom. You wrote an excellent piece back in December saying, wait a minute, there's a lot of good reasons to think that Trump would bring back the disinflation trade. So do you still see it that way? And give us a little bit of background on where that viewpoint comes from.
Well, I mean, the second question is a lot easier, the inflationary boom. So basically, I'm supposed to take it at face value because the markets are telling me that this is their view today. And their view today might not be the market's view 3, 6, 12 months from now or 5 years from now. But the markets are telling me that one man, President Trump, is going to be able to, with fiscal policy, will be able to do what Bernanke and Yellen and Draghi and Trichet and Kuroda and Carney, who actually run the printing presses, what they couldn't do in the past 8 years, a president's going to be willing to do or able to do on inflation. And the answer is no. That's just not going to happen. There's just too many powerful secular forces at play, whether it's demographics, intense global competitive pressures that aren't going away. And, of course, this the fact that you've got tremendous excess supply of retail space in the United States and Amazon creating tremendous margin pressure and price discounting in the rest of the consumer goods and services area. So no, I'm not a buyer of the view, and especially with the U.S. dollar likely to still be a strong currency, even though it's a very crowded trade, it's probably the right trade. I don't see the big inflation out there. People want to compare it to Ronald Reagan. Fine. I mean, there's differences. There's some similarities. What did inflation do during the Reagan era? What did inflation do during the supply-side Reagan era? It went from 12% down below 5% over his eight-year term. Why anybody thinks that Trump's policies themselves are going to create inflation? I imagine that the wall with Mexico will create demand for cement and concrete and the likes, and you'll see some commodity inflation perhaps coming out of there. Infrastructure, probably much the same. But that's a very small sliver of the overall inflation pie. And ultimately, what will matter for the markets is the extent to which any inflation at the back end of the economy comes to the front end of the economy. You know, when I look at Trump's policies, deregulation should reduce business costs. You know, what is inflationary about that? If the infrastructure works, the only way it's going to work is if it ultimately improves productivity, like the good old-fashioned Eisenhower infrastructure of the interstate highway in the 1950s really showed through in the 1960s in terms of increased productivity growth. Well, productivity growth in and of itself is anti-inflationary because it brings down unit labor costs. So what if Donald Trump reduces tax rates along with Congress corporate tax rates? Well, what's inflationary about lower corporate tax rates? It actually means that wages can rise without crimping margins and forcing companies to have to pass it on to consumers. So, you know, outside of cement, concrete, some base metals, the things that might go initially into the stuff that's needed to build a wall with Mexico or needed to, say, upgrade airports and pave bridges and roads, I don't see where the big inflationary impulse is going to come from. If anything, if Trump is successful, it means that the potential GDP growth rate, the non-inflationary GDP growth rate of the United States, is going to be rising over time. I can't build an inflation view out of that.
I'd like to go back and just review the evolution of your views in the equity markets, because you, of course, were very skeptical of the rally initially after the great financial crisis, and then you turned bullish a few years ago, and you've been absolutely right. And now I think recently, I don't want to put words in your mouth. Would you say you've turned bearish, or you've just turned skeptical and waiting to see what happened? Is it outright time to raise cash and get out of this market, or is it time to stay in the market cautiously? How do you see the market going ahead from here?
Well, look, to call for a bear market, you've got to call for a recession. I think recession odds for this year are pretty low. You know, we can talk numerically, but I don't think that, you know, that's going to add any credence. It's recession is this year a low. 2018 is a different kettle of fish altogether, and a lot of it will come down to not what Donald Trump does, but the Fed's reaction function to what Donald Trump does. So I'm not calling for a bear market this year. I'm not calling for a recession. But 2018 certainly has big question marks in front of it. But in terms of pullbacks, I mean, look what happened last year as a microcosm. Last year, we had four pullbacks in the S&P 500 of roughly 5% or more. And boy, you know, these days, if you're down 5% of the market, it feels like it's down 20. And we had four of those last year. And then we finished the year up, you know, call it roughly 10%. A lot of those gains, of course, coming after November the 8th. And that was the year last year where you had, you know, you had all these concerns about China's devaluation, emerging markets. We had the first quarter stagnation in the U.S. Then we had Brexit. Then we had the U.S. election. We had the Italian constitutional vote. And this year, you know, we have an untested president. We have three elections in Europe. We have the Chinese plenary at the end of the year. There's no shortage of things to be concerned about. And last year was a roller coaster ride in the markets. And if you take a look up until November the 8th, when we had this seemingly inflection point of the U.S. election, the S&P was barely up 4%. It was really almost a do-nothing year. And so I would say that this year is going to be a similar roller coaster ride. I think that anybody who doesn't see that there's a prospect of a pullback from these levels right now, when you consider, you know, the VIX, 10.7, my reading from this morning, valuations at 15-year highs, you know, practically, you know, every survey showing there's three or four market bulls for every bear out there. This is a market that's more than just fully priced. We have to respect the fact that on an interim basis, we are going to see pullbacks from extended levels. I'm not going to say this happens tomorrow or even next month. But I would say that if we had four pullbacks last year, I think we'll have as many of those this year, if not more. And my sense is that we'll finish the year probably roughly flat. That would be my call, but peppered with a lot of volatility.
So in that case, obviously the pullbacks that we had last year, if you had a perfect crystal ball, you'd know that each one of those was a buy-the-dip opportunity. Would you see a 5% pullback as a buy-the-dip opportunity, or is it time to get cautious that maybe the tide has changed here?
Well, I mean, you can't look at the tape and say the tide has turned. And, of course, there's the other side of the argument. And you always have to tip your hat and respect the other side of the argument that there's this wall of money just waiting to come in, that we're going to get another melt-up because on a fund flow basis, irrespective, you know, of where the valuations are and so on and so forth. The answer to your question is yes, I am skeptical. I would say that if we do pull back 5% and there's no recessionary signposts, well, naturally, that's going to be a buy-the-dip opportunity. The time to really make your fundamental asset mix shift ultra-defensive is when you're convinced that a recession is right around the corner. I don't think the business cycle is dead. It might be a little dormant, but it's certainly not dead. And the Fed is going to have a big say in this. And this is what I think the risks are more for 2018 than 2017. And it's a case of be careful what you wish for, because if you're out there thinking that, boy, Trump's going to get all the good stuff through and really none of the bad stuff on immigration, and the stuff on trade is all just posturing and negotiating. Well, let's say that we reach a situation where the Fed starts to lift its growth forecasts. its rate forecasts are not going to stay idle. They've already told us at a minimum they're going to raise rates three times this year. There's quite a few FOMC members that are at four rate hikes before Trump gets anything through Congress. So insofar as we get all this good stuff, it raises GDP growth with a sub 5% unemployment rate, which the Fed's spending more time examining now. It seems so from Janet Yellen that we're closer to full employment than she was even suggesting 3 or 4 months ago. There's been a slight change in her cadence. But as Ronald Reagan found out, and as you aptly described at the beginning, keep your eye on the Fed. That's the elephant in the room. And every recession in the post-World War II period did not have fiscal policy thumbprints all over it. It was always about the Fed. And monetary policy will trump fiscal policy for the business cycle every day of the week. So that, to me, is going to be the primary risk, is how much of the good stuff comes through. How does the Fed respond? The lags are such that this makes 2018 problematic for the business cycle as opposed to this year.
I want to come back to the topic of monetary policy outlook in just a minute. But first, let's touch on the U.S. dollar. Obviously, this dollar rally has been the big story in markets. And it seems like we've got kind of a dichotomy here between what Donald Trump says versus what he does. And recently, of course, he's made several comments suggesting that the dollar's too high. And it seems like everybody's panicking on that. But on the other hand, it seems to me that all of his policies are extremely dollar bullish. And I suppose the other side of that coin is it's a pretty overcrowded trade on the long side right now. So if this rhetoric maybe spooks people out of the market, it could cause a big move. How do you see this evolving from here?
Well, I think that the market participants should be aware of the things that the president has control over and what he doesn't. So there's a lot of things he's doing through executive order right now in terms of deregulation, the wall, foreign policy, a lot of stuff. But in terms of the dollar, he can air out his views, but what can he really do about it? Is he going to instruct the Treasury to start intervening in the foreign exchange market to suppress the U.S. dollar? Hardly likely. Is he going to start to meddle in the Fed? I mean, the Fed that he was complaining about Janet Yellen months ago, that she was suppressing interest rates to get Barack Obama reelected and that she was keeping rates artificially low, is he now going to say to her, no, don't raise rates? So the bottom line here is just classic textbook economics. The U.S., this is just a fact, not an opinion, has a tighter monetary policy relative to its trading partners. That's going to continue. It seems to me as though fiscal policy in the United States is going to be much more accommodative than it is in other parts of the world, at least for the next year or so. Tighter money, easier fiscal, will always and everywhere lead to a stronger currency. This is one of those rare times where the overwhelming consensus is still probably the right trade, as overcrowded as it is.
Okay, and before we move on to monetary policy, since you're with a Canadian firm and we have a lot of Canadian listeners, how about the Canadian dollar outlook relative to the U.S. dollar and the rest of the world for that matter?
Well, it's interesting because the Canadian dollar right now is around 131, call it roughly 75 cents. When you take a look at where oil is, remember 12 months ago, 24 months ago, oil was dominating everything, including the Canadian dollar. It was almost 100% correlation. Today, that correlation has weakened somewhat. If you're looking at WTI oil at $52, $53 a barrel, and you just ran some simple model on the Canadian dollar as a standalone event, that should have the Canadian dollar closer to 125 or 80 cents. So the Canadian dollar, in quotes, should be a nickel stronger than it is based solely on the oil price. But this is not 12 or 24 months ago. The oil price is not dominating the Canadian dollar as much as it was. And what has taken over the dominating role is Bank Canada policy. So as the Fed raises interest rates, as it pledges to do more, Governor Poloz here in Canada has made it very clear that the Bank of Canada is not doing anything this year and probably not next year either. So what's driving the Canadian dollar are these negative interest rate differentials at the right across the yield curve, but it's going to probably be accentuated by this diverging monetary policy over the next several months. I think that will act more to depress the Canadian dollar than add impetus to it. And when I get to ask the question, you know, where's the next 5 cent move in the Canadian dollar? You know, will we see 70 cents or will we see 80 cents? You know, as a classical economist, I say both. We'll probably see in the next year 70 and 80 cents, but my sense is though we'll see the lower end of that before we see the upper end.
And coming back to monetary policy, we're being told now to expect 3 or 4 rate hikes in 2017. Of course, I think a lot of people forget that if you go back a year, we were told this time last year to expect that many rate hikes in 2016, and they didn't happen. So what do you see in terms of Fed hikes, FOMC policy in general, and particularly how FOMC policy will interact with Donald Trump's agenda in the coming year?
Well, there's no question that the Fed got scared off last year, and I know a lot of that was the early year jitters in emerging markets and all the concerns about China's potential big devaluation. And then we immediately went from that, to Brexit and all the uncertainties related to the U.S. election. And we can't deny the fact that, you know, on average, GDP growth in the United States last year was 1.6%, tied for the weakest year of the cycle and down a full percentage point in terms of growth from where we were in 2015. All that said, the Fed has told us once again, and it could be the case of the boy who cried wolf. You know, just remember that at the end of the story, the wolf does show up. That I think it's a case for the Fed this year of, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me. And my sense is that there's a little bit of buyer's remorse that they didn't take out or at least raise rates 1 or 2 more times last year with the benefit of 2020 hindsight. So my sense is that I think we should still take them at their word. I think what makes this year maybe different than the other years is that instead of the Fed doing less, the Fed could end up doing more. I mean, what's astonishing in terms of how the market is really taking on the Fed and looking at the whites of the eyes is that even after the central bank has told us that they're going to raise rates minimally 3 times this year, before Trump gets anything passed that ups the Fed's GDP growth forecast, the Fed has told us they're going to raise rates at least 3 times. The market's barely priced for 2. So if you're going to ask me among all the risks for this year, there's certainly a lot of political risks in Europe, that is for sure. I think there's still concerns about the extent to which excessive credit has fueled the 6.5% growth rate that we're seeing in China. There's other concerns as well. But the Fed overreacting to what Donald Trump does, I think is, again, a serious market risk. It's not evident to the eye right now, but I think it could be as we move through the balance of the year.
Let's pick up on your comment about the risk in the European Union. I just saw a piece this morning that supposedly Trump's new ambassador is already saying short the euro because he thinks there may not be a European Union to negotiate with a year from now. It's unprecedented, in my opinion, to hear such strong comments from an incoming government official. Do you think it's that dire? Do you think that the EU is at risk of breaking up? And what would be the knock-on effects of that in terms of the U.S. dollar and everything else?
Right. Well, it's a. I wouldn't say that these fringe right-wing parties getting in, the real hardcore anti-EU coming into power in the Netherlands and France or in Germany, I wouldn't make that a base case scenario. But that doesn't really matter in the sense that, you know, how the markets operate is on expected values and on probabilities. And this is certainly a tail risk of governments in core countries, you know, following in Britain's footsteps. So I think that it's not a base case scenario for me, but the odds of it happening certainly aren't trivial. And what's more important is that, you know, even if the breakup of the EU is, say, you know, 10, 15, or even 20% odds, it's then what is the market reaction to that? And you have to embed not just the probabilities, but also, you know, what's the likely outcome in global currencies, bond markets, commodities, and equities. So we have to work on all that. The odds are low, but they're not trivial. And I think that it would be very, very severe in terms of what it would mean for the world. It's one thing to have the UK, which has always sort of had a step in and a step out. You know, they weren't part of the euro. But another thing to have something that, you know, for all its flaws and its warts and its scars and the bureaucracy involved with the EU and maybe the added costs, the reality is that what it produced was a peaceful Europe. I mean, I think we're living in a period of time now of the past, say, 6 decades. Really, it's an 8% chance of this happening that Europe could go this long without a war. And I think that that is really what people miss out on when they complain about all the Davos liberals and you know, the establishment and so on and so forth, they miss out on what the true benefit for the global economy and society is. That when you take a look at wars historically, they're always coming out of Europe, and what the EU did was provide that cohesiveness. So that's the principal risk, I think, from a geopolitical standpoint. And I think it's something that, you know, it's hard to handicap the odds. But after what happened last year, you know, between how the British voted, how the Americans voted, and even how the Italians voted, we're in a uncharted territory here. And there's a lot of disenfranchised and disenchanted parts of populations everywhere that want to see a political change. You know, you can have the political change in Canada where you actually vote in an establishment party, but one that had been in the wilderness for a decade but reinvented itself. Interestingly enough, here we have the Liberals in Ottawa, led by Justin Trudeau, and one of the few governments around that actually is still carrying around the free trade banner. But we've already seen what's happened last year. I don't want to necessarily say that I want to superimpose that on what's going to happen politically this year. But the EU, certainly, that is a very big political tail risk, and one that shouldn't be dismissed out of hand.
I'm personally convinced that the $64 trillion question for 2017 is whether or not the 35-year bond bull market really is over the way Jeff Gundlach has suggested. Gundlach has said we're headed back to 6% yields, and personally, I can't figure out how you get back to 6% 10-year yields without the U.S. government going broke trying to service its debt. So what do you see for the bond market? Do you buy this story that the secular bull market could be over in bonds, and if so, what does that mean in terms of what's next?
I don't buy it at all. And look, all I'll say is that, you know, in 2009, 2010, you know, when the Fed embarked on QE, along with 0% interest rates, every Tom, Dick, and Harry portfolio manager and bond market pundit out there was screaming about the end of the secular bull market in bonds. This is just basically, I mean, you're going back 6 or 7 years. I remember my former firm coming out with published reports, you know, talking about the great rotation from bonds into stocks. Stocks certainly did very well in this cycle, but it wasn't because it was fueled by retail inflows out of bonds into stocks. We know that that didn't happen from a fund flow perspective. And so the bond bearers have been wrong all along, and I think they'll continue to be wrong until we actually see sustained above-trend GDP growth that eliminates the global output gap. And I think that that is still some time away. So, look, I think that people out there are entitled to their opinions. You know, Bill Gross recently said that we cross above 2.6% based on the thickness of his pencil. That marks the end of the bull market. I don't look at it that way. I look at it that when you take a look at the 10-year note, or you can look at the long bond for that matter, in each cycle, the highs in yield are getting lower and the lows are getting lower. The highs are getting lower and the lows are getting lower. And so we'll have to wait and see, you know, how far this thing goes. I would think that to really call for the secular bull market to be over, I think we'd have to cross well above 4%. And we're not going to get anywhere close to that, in my opinion. And in fact, when you take a look, everything happening right now, and you know, we had 100 basis point backup of the 10-year note from where it was in July. That much is true. But I mean, come on. In July, the deflation was dripping off everybody's tongue. We had Europe and Japan going towards negative rates. We didn't know how Brexit was going to lead to a recession, not just there, but bring the EU into a recession as well. That was the mindset at the time. So, I mean, at that point, you had 40-year JGBs at zero, 10-year Treasuries were at, you know, call it 135. So we've backed up since then over 100 basis points. That much is true. This is about the eighth time we've had a backup of this magnitude in the past decade. They come and they go. I just think that there's still too many powerful secular forces at play. Global competitive pressures, aging demographics in the industrialized world, and we just have too much debt globally to withstand rises in market rates much more than we already have done. And then I look back and I say, Dow 20,000, stock market, you know, melting up, the VIX below 11, you know, 15-year high valuations in the stock market, commodities ripping, oil doubling over the past year. And I look at the 10-year note at, call it 2.5%, and I can only say, that's all you get for your money? I mean, even if we go to 275 or 3, seriously, considering everything happening out there, all the inflationary mindset of practically everybody talking on bubble vision and everything you read in the newspapers, and this is all you can really do is 250, 260 in the 10-year note. You just start to wonder what happens when things start to unravel, because there will be a recession at some point. I'll say this right now. It's a guarantee that we will have a recession at some point because the business cycle is not dead. We can debate as to what year that happens. But here's what we know. We know that bond yields make new lows in recessions. And we know that there's going to be a recession at some point. And the most you can do right now at the peak of the cycle is 260 on the 10-year note. It really tells you something. So, no, I'm not really buying in, notwithstanding the fact that bond yields are trading higher. That could happen again for the next several months. It wouldn't surprise me. Will it be sustained? And my answer is an emphatic no.
Let's touch on precious metals briefly. Gold, of course, a recent cycle low was around 1124, bounced a good almost $100 to 1220. Looks to be rolling over again as maybe this softness in the U.S. dollar might be ending. What do you see there? Is gold just an anti-dollar trade, or is something else driving it, and where do you think we're headed from here?
Well, I think that gold is really caught here between its role as a insurance hedge, really, against things going wrong. And I don't mean so much inflation, but the geopolitics. You know, how do you measure gold, or how do you value gold? I mean, gold isn't like a bond, you know, where you can do estimate a real rate, inflation expectations, a term premium, or in the credit market, when you're evaluating spreads, you look at default rates and recovery rates. And it's not like an equity market where you can do a dividend discount model or look at price to book, price to earnings, dividends. No. What's gold? How do you value gold? Gold is one divided by T, where T is trust. And you would tend to find, actually, when gold had its best days in the past several years, it was centered around geopolitical uncertainty. A lot of that was either coming out of the government shutdowns in the U.S., the debt ceiling situations, problems in Greece, so on and so forth. So gold is really an insurance policy against things somehow going wrong. I don't think I'd be buying gold because of any inflation view. I don't think we're going to be getting big inflation, even though we're seeing some cyclical pressures, which are not unusual. You're buying gold really as an insurance policy against things going wrong, either in terms of global trade through this protectionist bent among the administration, or, say, something happening with the EU, in which case the dollar probably would rally, but gold would probably rally as well. I think the knock against gold really is going to be what we talked about before, which is the fact that the one thing we do know is that, barring something unforeseen, the Fed's raising rates 3 times, no matter what. They've already told us that before Trump does anything, and no other central bank is touching rates. And the most important determinant of exchange rate valuation, since currencies are a pair trade, one against the other, is relative interest rate differentials. And my sense is that that will continue to move in the U.S. dollar's favor. That will end up curbing gold to a large extent because gold's priced in dollars. But also the risk is that real rates start to rise. And real rates and the gold price do have this time-worn historical inverse correlation. So my sense is that if you're buying gold today, you're really only buying it against the backdrop of heightened geopolitical risk for the coming year. There's really no other reason to go long gold right now, unless you have a big inflation view, which I don't.
Okay, and finally, I'd like to just ask more of an open-ended question. As you look at your radar for the rest of 2017, what do you see in terms of macro trends and trades that people should be thinking about?
Well, I think this is going to be a case where we're going to be finding, I think, heightened volatility. And the VIX at 10.7 right now is not sustainable. I think it's going to be, you know, if last year was a, I would say that this year, it's going to be a roller coaster ride benchmarked against last year's merry-go-round. I think there's going to be a lot more volatility. It means there's going to be a lot more opportunity if you're nimble and you're disciplined and you take profits quickly to raise some dry powder or some cash to put to work. So it's going to mean, you know, it's a glib remark to say that it's a trader's market, a stock trader's market. It always is. But I think it's going to be like that this year by several standard deviations against any historical norm you want to use. I think it's going to be a year of value over growth. I think it's going to be a year in the U.S. where you probably want to stay local as opposed to export-oriented in terms of your exposure, because we don't know how the administration is going to influence cross-border trade or, you know, border taxes or what this means for global supply chains. in terms of what that means, especially for Silicon Valley. So it's going to be very much, I think, special situation and a focus on local as opposed to foreign flavor. I think the financials still make sense, especially if the Fed's going to raise rates and provide some margin. And I think that really, it's, when I say special situation, think of the areas of the economy and the market that are going to do well no matter what the White House does. And so I think energy, capital spending related to energy is going to be a very good place to be. I think that's going to be a big growth engine for the U.S. this year. It's going to be energy CapEx, especially out of the shale area. And so that should be, I think, a prime area of focus. You know, outside of that, you know, there's going to be some opportunities. Obviously, Canada is going to have some with the currency cheap and giving a boost to industrials and transports here. The Canadian banks look pretty good with decent dividend yields. And I think overseas, if you're going to ask me what the big turnaround story is, it's right in front of our eyes, and it's called Japan. And Japan's one of the few areas of the world that's trading at a price-earnings multiple discount to its historical norm. And Abenomics is finally starting to kick in. And I don't mean in terms of just the economy, but you're starting to see companies respond by getting rid of that cash off the balance sheet towards more productive uses, which over time is going to give them a relative boost in the returns on equity, which have lagged so far behind their competitors over the past several years. So there's going to be some areas out there that look very interesting to me. And a lot of them, like I said, U.S. energy, Japan, the Canadian financials would be in a global portfolio, the three things I'd want to be focused on.
Fantastic, Dave. I really appreciate it. Before we close, though, I want to touch on your newsletter, which is one of my favorite in the industry. Breakfast with Dave, of course. There's a free version of that, which is kind of a teaser with a lot of really interesting bullet points every day. But the full-on version is excellent. We have obtained a sample copy of Breakfast with Dave. I think we've actually got a couple of days worth of the daily Breakfast with Dave, as well as an interview that you did with Peter Mann, the CIO at Gluskin Sheff, talking about your outlook for 2017. So thanks very much. All of our registered users will receive that in your research roundup email that came out with this podcast. For people who are interested in the newsletter, can you tell us a little bit more about Breakfast with Dave and what the parameters are?
Well, I've been doing the newsletter under different titles since I was at the Bank of Montreal back in the late 1990s. And it's really a distillation of my views of the market, the economy. It's got a little bit of humor, sometimes a little bit of sardonic sarcasm. But it's basically aimed at highlighting to investors what's going on around the world and what they should be paying attention to. You know, so there's a lot of stuff that's long-term in nature in there that doesn't change. And there's a lot of stuff that wiggles around the long-term trend line that I try and highlight as well, some of the short-term stuff. So it's a hodgepodge, really, of politicals, economics, and finance, you know, written in a way that investors can understand. And again, it's all about what I've always tried to do for the client base, which is to take the economics, connect the dots, and come up with a cogent and coherent investment strategy out of it. And so that's really what it attempts to do every single day.
Well, it's definitely one of my favorite daily newsletters. It's one of very few that really is every day, and there's substantive content. I don't know what time you wake up in the morning to start writing Breakfast with Dave, but it's quite amazing that you put out so much content every day. Finally, before we close, Gluskin Sheff Wealth Management also may be of interest. Give us just a very quick overview of what you guys do there at Gluskin Sheff.
Well, we are Canada's preeminent wealth manager. We manage money for high income, for high net worth Canadians, not just Canadians, but Americans. We have roughly 10% of our client base in the U.S. Of course, a lot of Americans want to get some toehold into the 51st state and buy the Canadian dollar. You know, well, it's at the low end of its historical range. But we manage across the asset classes, across fixed income, credit hedge funds in particular, and Canadian, U.S., and global equities. Of course, our U.S. clients really want us to be the leaders for heading their Canadian mandate. That is our backyard. But we invest globally, and we invest across the asset classes. We have $9 billion in assets, and we've been around since 1984. So, you know, please come to the website and look us up.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Dave, for a fantastic interview. In the interest of time, we do need to leave it there, but Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests at macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
I have to say those were some great insights from David. His views help better put into perspective some of the considerations in the Trump reflation trade. I particularly found his views on interest rates in the U.S. dollar quite interesting.
Yeah, I thought particularly his view on interest rates. You know, we're seeing more experts coming on the program saying that they're not convinced that, you know, even these luminaries like Jeff Gundlach and Bill Gross may not be right about this thing. So I'm undecided on interest rates, but I think it is the most important question of the year for sure. Anyway, folks, I have a challenge here, which is integrating Patrick into the program as our new co-host is a difficult task because Patrick brings so many different skills to the table here. For those of you who were not aware of Patrick's background, in addition to running BigPictureTrading.com, he's also an instructor and educator for the TMX Exchange up in Canada. He trains not only retail investors, but also industry professionals. And one of his specialties is option trading. So for now, that's what I'm going to focus on in terms of bringing Patrick's perspective to the program. My own view is that options are often misunderstood by investors. Speculators that have unrealistic goals are often drawn to options trading because out of the money options provide so much leverage, and of course that usually results in a disappointing outcome. So I think the stereotype of options trading gives this view of huge amounts of risk and so forth, when in reality, options can be used as very defensive, conservative strategies. So what I'd like to do, Patrick, is leverage some of your talents to focus on some of the less well-known strategies. In particular, a lot of our listeners are big fans of precious metals, but there is a very strong criticism of precious metals, which is gold and silver don't produce income, and it's difficult to justify holding an asset in your portfolio long-term that doesn't earn any money. So the surface of this, what the heck does that have to do with options? Please explain.
Well, Eric, gold is like any asset, and the markets go through bull and bear market cycles and often have these large dead zones of inactivity. To assign arbitrary probabilities, gold is rising one-third of the time, correcting one-third of the time, and range-bound one-third of the time. So accepting this generalization, two-thirds of the time you own an asset that is not going higher, and you don't earn any interest or dividends on it. This is where you can overlay strategic options writing strategies to create an income stream, strategies including covered call writing, selling puts, and credit spreads. In general, selling option premiums tend to be viewed as alpha-creating strategies because they reduce the volatility and can enhance your returns in most market environments.
So in other words, even though the gold and silver don't produce income directly, you can write options against them and produce income, allowing them to effectively produce a return equivalent to holding something like treasuries. And just to be clear for our listeners, selling an option premium is an income strategy because you're credited the premium with the positive theta that you're being paid for over time. So the best way to illustrate that is with an example. Patrick, let's assume that the hypothetical investor has a component of their portfolio in gold, and they're looking at generating an annualized income on that, which is comparable, let's say, to a 10-year treasury bond that yields in the 2.5% or 3% range.
Now, Eric, we have to differentiate the different types of gold investors because I know some people physically own the gold and gold certificates. There's others that trade their positions in the futures markets, and yet another set of investors that own gold through the ETFs like the GLD. The simplest way to illustrate this is an example using that GLD ETF. An investor can simply sell an out-of-the-money covered call to get their targeted premium. So as we are recording this, the GLD was trading very close to the 113 level. In building a narrative, let's assume that from a macro perspective, we feel that the U.S. dollar will act as a headwind for gold, and we suspect that gold will be far more range-bound in the first half of this year. To get a treasury-style yield, we could sell, in this case, a June $130 strike-covered call, which is $17 out of the money, and receive a premium very close to around a dollar. That's for a 141-day obligation out till the June expiration. That gives you an upside all the way up to $130, and the premium annualizes at about 2.35%, which is close to the current yields on treasuries.
Now, investors that are looking for far more enhanced income can focus on shorter term, closer at the money calls. But that, of course, involves more market timing and more risk. I just want to make it clear to our listeners, if a large macro bull market in gold starts, you could always buy back those obligations early. So you don't have to just because you wrote the option. You don't have to be held accountable for it. You can always exit that position by buying back the option that you sold. Patrick, the same opportunity exists to sell calls in the futures market, but what do you do if you physically own the gold in a safe in your house? You've got physical metal as opposed to a financial instrument. What do you do then?
Well, that makes it slightly more complicated. But one of the ways that you can create income is to consider credit spreads. What you are doing with that is synthetically writing premium against that gold you physically hold. And you're using the spread trading as a way to manage the margin requirements and containing the risk, because investors that physically own the gold have no desire to be called away.
That's definitely food for thought. And of course, this same type of strategy could be used for any other asset for that matter, whether it's income producing or not. You're basically producing income by writing options that are covered by assets that you hold in your account. And that's just one of a number of strategies. What I'd like to sort of shift to at this point is to ask our listeners for feedback. Patrick and I talked about, okay, where do we go with introducing Patrick's perspectives and background into the program? I thought that for our precious metals holders, you know, the idea of how to generate some income might be a good option. There were a lot of other things that we could have talked about. One of the things that Patrick and I discussed off the air that he teaches to a lot of his people is just a technique of writing options rather than using limit orders in order to enter a new position. You know, allow someone to pay you to force you to do what you were going to do anyway. Is this kind of conversation useful? Is this where we should be going as we introduce Patrick? Or do we want to talk about other aspects of trading? Please give us some feedback because we're trying to find exactly the right place. Patrick brings so many different talents and so much background to the table that frankly, I'm trying to decide what the best way to integrate his skill and knowledge into the format out of the program is. So we really appreciate feedback from our listeners on that topic.
Well, thanks, Eric. And I'm glad to be here. And I'm really looking forward to continuing to contribute to the program in the weeks and months ahead. Anything else you want to add before we do our wrap-up?
Well, we got David Rosenberg this week. In the next couple weeks, folks, you can expect some more really big names. How is that possible? It's because of your help, and we need more of it. We really need, we're starting to get enough traction that we can get some of the big names. We've got Kyle Bass's people at least answering our calls now. We haven't got a commitment to get Kyle in the program. If anyone has his ear, please tell him when his staff asks him, as they've promised to do, whether he wants to do a Macro Voices interview, that it's worth his time. And again, if you can help us to promote the program by telling your friends about it, retweeting us when we announce the show on Twitter, and most importantly, go to macrovoices.com and sign up for your free account. You can do that in just a couple of minutes. The benefit to you is that you receive our free research roundup email, which is a compendium of all of the cool free stuff we could find on the internet each week, both with respect to our feature interview guest and in general other research we could find. Patrick, what have we got for him this week in the research roundup?
Well, the first thing, like we started last week, we've started to provide transcripts of all the interviews. And so just the way with Raoul Paul last week, we are now going to have a transcript available for this entire interview with David Rosenberg. Now, the link is going to be in that research roundup email, but the link is only going to be active about 24 hours after, as we still need time to actually produce it. In addition to that, David Rosenberg shared with us several of his Breakfast with Dave newsletters, including the links where listeners can actually get a two-week free trial to accessing those daily newsletters. So make sure you check those out. In addition to that, in our research roundup, we have a Bloomberg video of an interview with Kyle Bass discussing China, German bonds, and Trump. I actually really enjoyed that. It was 15 minutes long, and he basically nailed almost all of those topics that he's been discussing in the last many months, even year. As well, we have an article discussing the recent insider selling by all the bank executives. There's also an additional article from CNBC discussing Jeffrey Gunlatch's view on Trump and the U.S. dollar. These and many more links are available in that research roundup email. Now, if you have not yet registered, make sure you visit that macrovoices.com website and register for free. Well, that's it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the suggestions and feedback we get from our listeners. So please feel free to email us on how we can improve the show. Those of you that write your own blogs or provide research about the markets and would like to share that work with our listeners, feel free to email us at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter. If you haven't already, you could follow us on Twitter at Macro Voices. And as well, you could follow Eric directly at Eric S. Townsend. So on behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the Internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.